All right, so just a quick review of what we covered last week. We're in the final section of the historical overview. So we're right up to the Roman era, which of course brings us right up to the time of the New Testament and the birth of Jesus. And so we're finishing off this last historical section. And then what we'll probably be doing for the rest of the remaining time in Sunday school is going over the literature of the intertestamental period. So that's kind of where we're headed. We'll probably begin that next week. So hopefully today we can finish off the historical section. So if you remember from last week, or actually maybe the last 2 weeks, there was a civil war that occurred between two of the Hasmonean brothers, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. And if you have your Hasmonean dynasty family tree here, you can see those two brothers. They were the sons of Janneus Alexander. And if you remember, they had a civil war, Aristobulus being the ambitious one and Hyrcanus being the one who was the high priest. But Aristobulus quickly exerted his authority and took over, sort of relegating Hyrcanus to private life. But then later on, there was further conflict between them that was instigated somewhat by Antipater, who we'll talk about more here in a moment. And then you recall that the Roman general Pompey had to intervene in Jerusalem and ended up conquering Jerusalem, conquering the Temple Mount, and that was in 63 BC, which really marked the end of Jewish independence. After that, Hyrcanus was confirmed as the high priest. He was also named the ethnarch of Judea by the Romans, and then from then on, we enter the period of Roman domination of Palestine, which is, of course, the way we find things when we open the pages of the New Testament. Then we also talked a little bit about the sort of what was happening at the same time back in Rome. So there was a lot of political intrigue going on in Rome. If you remember the story, just very briefly, Rome had been ruled by the Republic up till about 49 BC. So Pompey was dominant during that period, and he was one of the foremost Roman generals, and he had conquered a lot of lands in the east, which is why he was the one that is in view with respect to Palestine, and why he was responsible for subduing Jerusalem. But then if you know your Roman history later, Julius arose, later known as Julius Caesar, and there was a war between Julius and Pompey. And then Julius, of course, won that conflict, and Pompey was killed in Egypt. And Julius was really the Caesar from 48 up to 44 BC when he was assassinated by Brutus and Cassius, if you remember your history again. And then we had another period of basically civil war between Brutus and Cassius and two folks who had been supporters of Julius, and that was Antony and Octavian. And Octavian, you remember, was Julius Caesar's heir. So Antony and Octavian battled Brutus and Cassius and defeated them. And that brings us up to the period, really a later period, but the period of Caesar Augustus. And I was kind of joking last time because my kids were here in class and they're studying Roman history right now, and that they know more about Roman history than I do at this point. And sure enough, afterwards, Brendan comes up to me and says, "You forgot to mention the triumvirate." So Antony and Octavian, and there was a third person by the name of Lepidus. That was the famous Roman triumvirate, again, if you know your Roman history. So Lepidus was killed shortly thereafter, and it really became Antony and Octavian. And following the defeat of Brutus and Cassius, Antony and Octavian agreed to share power ruling east and west, respectively. So Antony was the one that was in charge of the east, which is the area of Palestine. And we'll see Antony being involved in the subsequent section here that we're studying. But then there was a power struggle, just kind of jumping ahead, there was a power struggle between Antony and Octavian that ultimately resulted in Octavian's victory over Antony, and at this point we have Antony and Cleopatra. Cleopatra is in the story now. So Octavian defeated Antony and Cleopatra at a famous naval battle by the name of Actium in 31 BC. And that pretty much established Octavian as the sole ruler of the Roman Empire. And then he was, of course, later in 27 BC, so 4 years later. He was awarded the title of Augustus and lifelong tribuneship in 23 BC. So effectively, Caesar Augustus, who was previously known as Octavian, became the first Roman emperor. And of course, then we see the long line of Roman emperors after him. So that was kind of all happening in parallel with what we're going to talk about more today, which is the rise of the Herodian family. So that kind of hopefully gives you a sense of what was happening politically in the Roman Empire. And that's important background for the events that were happening in Palestine, which were where we see the rise of the Herodian family. And of course, that's of great interest to us because that's what we find when we open the pages of the New Testament. So that brings us kind of to where we were last time. We briefly started into the first section here of talking about this interesting character by the name of Antipater. And Antipater was an important individual. He was an Idumean, and last time we talked about Idumea is the area that's south of Judea, and it's an area that was heavily influenced by the Edomites. The Edomites, of course, come from further east. And Idumeans are also sometimes referred to as Edomites. But it was an area in, you know, the territory of Israel under the monarchy, but it was the area south of Judea. So that was Antipater's descent and where he came from. And he was a consummate politician. So we'll see this is a theme throughout the family of the Herods, is how they were very good politicians. And it all began here with Antipater. So during the civil war that we just talked about between the two Hasmonean brothers, remember Aristobulus had exerted himself and sort of relegated Hyrcanus to the background and made him a private citizen. Well, Antipater saw an opportunity here, I think, to exert some of his own influence at this point in time in the region. And so what he did is he aligned himself with Hyrcanus and essentially convinced Hyrcanus to put himself forward again as a rightful ruler. So you sort of had the idea of Antipater propping up Hyrcanus as his legitimate frontman, because remember, he was a legitimate Hasmonean from the Hasmonean rulers. So he aligned himself with Hyrcanus and then subsequently aligned Hyrcanus as well as Antipater aligned themselves with Rome. So they saw an opportunity to gain power through positioning themselves with Rome. And then we learned last week how Pompey ruled on behalf of Hyrcanus because he really believed that Aristobulus was reckless and dangerous and very aggressive. And so that was, of course, the occasion when Pompey stormed Jerusalem and conquered the Temple Mount. And so after that, Hyrcanus was set up as the high priest. And he was also given title of ethnarch of Judea. So Antipater is in the background here as sort of the trusted advisor to the Hasmonean ruler Hyrcanus. Antipater continued to support and act on behalf of the Romans. There were a number of regional conflicts that I've kind of not mentioned during this period. And Antipater was always the friend of Rome. He was supporting Rome throughout this period in some material ways. And then, so when Julius came to the dictatorship, essentially, in Rome, he appointed Antipater the procurator of Judea. And at this point, we see his son Herod enter the picture. Herod was named the governor of Galilee. So now we see Antipater actually receiving political authority as a procurator under Roman rule by Julius Caesar, and Herod was appointed the governor of Galilee. Now, what happened here is there was a lot of instability in Rome, as I just mentioned. First of all, we have Julius taking over the dictatorship, essentially establishing a dictatorship in Rome. And then shortly after that, in 44 BC, Julius Caesar was assassinated by Brutus and Cassius. And then there was civil war after that between the followers of Brutus and Cassius and the followers of Julius, who were Antony and Octavian. So there's another civil war that's going on. And that civil war was carried on for several years. And then later we had the power struggle between Octavian and Antony. So it's sort of this constant churning and conflict. in Roman politics, which really that instability in Rome led to instability in Palestine as well, which you might expect. So there was a lot of opportunity for people to manipulate things and put themselves forward in Judea as well. And that's basically what we see here. So when Julius Caesar was assassinated, Cassius, who was a proconsul of Syria, so the Syrian ruler, began to, he really seized his Antipater's territory in Judea. And then Antipater was in 43 BC, which is a year later now, was assassinated by supporters of Hyrcanus and the Hasmonean house. So this is an interesting development. Antipater had aligned himself with Hyrcanus, but now he was viewed as, you know, he was in power for the Romans. So the followers of Hyrcanus or the Hasmonean family wanted him out of the way so Hyrcanus could assume the leadership. And so this is kind of ironic because there's some debate, by the way, whether Hyrcanus was actually involved in this or not, or if it was done unbeknownst to him by his followers. But there was conflict there. Antipater was assassinated, and that sort of ironically removed a person who had been a stable mediator between the Hasmoneans and the Romans. So they sort of unwittingly brought trouble upon themselves by assassinating Antipater. So that's kind of just a bunch of very confusing events that were happening there at this time. But all of this is really the occasion then that Herod the Great could assert his authority and come to power. And so after Antipater, the father of Herod, was assassinated, Herod exerted his authority. Remember, he was the governor of Galilee. He exerted his authority and he tracked down and killed the man responsible for assassinating his father, which really showed how he was stepping in and taking a position of leadership. And then following the assassination of Julius Caesar, which remember it happened just like a year or two earlier from the events where we're talking about here, he had wisely, again, aligned himself with Antony and Octavian against Brutus and Cassius. They had their allegiance with Julius, who had been supportive of Antipater and Herod. And following his assassination, they aligned themselves with his, really his successors, which were Antony and Octavian. And so Herod aligned himself with Antony and Octavian. And Antony, because he had been given rule over the eastern part of the Roman Empire, which encompassed Judea and Syria, he became a very close ally with Herod. Or maybe you can say it the other way around. Herod became a close ally of Antony because he realized that Antony was the Roman power in the area. But because of all the churn and all of these wars that were going on in Rome, there were still opportunities for people to mess with Palestine, basically. So now we have the Parthians again, which we mentioned briefly last week. The Parthians saw an opportunity here, and they invaded Jerusalem at this time in Judea and conquered Jerusalem. And again, under the guise of restoring Hasmonean rule. So if you remember the two brothers there, Hyrcanus was in power with Antipater and Herod, and his brother Aristobulus had been captured and taken off to Rome, and his son as well. If you look at your family tree, you can see one of his sons, Antigonus, or Antigonus, was his son, and he escaped from Rome, fled to the Parthians. Now, the Parthians were enemies of Rome in the east, and so they conspired to invade Jerusalem, set up Antigonus as the ruler in place of Hyrcanus. And then the Parthians wanted to do this, of course, because they were pushing back against Roman rule and trying to take Roman territory. So anyways, in 40 BC, they came and conquered Jerusalem, which this was the occasion that we mentioned last week of Hyrcanus being taken captive. And Antigonus, Hyrcanus is Antigonus' uncle, if you can keep this all straight. But he maimed Hyrcanus, clipped his ears, so that he wouldn't be able to reassume the high priesthood. So, with the Parthian invasion in 40 BC, Herod, who's a ruler in the area here, is in trouble. There's also a brother of Herod who's in trouble as well that I have kind of left out of the story here for brevity. But Herod had to flee. And he basically moved his family to the fortress of Masada, which you may know of from history. And he left his family there at the fortress and escaped through Egypt. And then he made his way to Rome, where his friends were. So Herod was forced out in 40 BC. Well, when Herod arrived in Rome in 40 BC, he went before the Roman Senate. And this is when Herod was appointed king of the Jews, the king of Judea at this point. So officially, he's given a kingship of Judea. Now, there's a few distinctions here. He's not just a Roman procurator or a provincial ruler. He's actually named a king of that area, which means he has some level of autonomy in his rule. So that kind of is a little bit of a testimony, I think, to Rome's confidence in Herod being able to rule this kingdom satisfactorily. And really what Rome is interested in is maintaining peace in the empire, protecting their borders, and collecting taxes. And so if they thought that Herod was able to do that effectively, that's why they would allow him to be king. So that's a testimony, I think, of their support. There's one other interesting note here that I found in some of the writings here. Herod left the country of Judea and went to Rome and had himself proclaimed king in Rome in a faraway country. I don't know if that reminds you of anything in the New Testament. Probably not. It's a little obscure reference. But some people speculate that this is the context that Jesus had in mind when he gave the parable of the 10 minas. You remember the parable of the king who goes away to a faraway country to have himself named king, and then he comes back and checks on what the servants had been doing with the minas. Some people believe that Jesus had Herod going off to a foreign country to be proclaimed king and then coming back as a contextual reference that his hearers would have connected with. So that story is in Luke chapter 19, but I found that an interesting side note here. So that kind of sets the stage with all the political intrigue and the civil wars and everything for how Herod came into power. Now he still has a problem because he's a king of Judea, but Judea isn't in Roman hands at this point in time. The Parthians are in Jerusalem. And one of his rivals, Aristobulus, is being put forward as the high priest and the ruler. So what did he do about that? Well, Herod returned to Jerusalem in 37 BC with Roman support now, Roman armies, to conquer Palestine and recapture it. So he was able in 37 BC to recapture Jerusalem with Roman help. Antigonus, who was the one who had been set forward, I think a minute ago I said Aristobulus, but I meant Antigonus, who was the son of Aristobulus, was the one that had been set up by the Parthians. He was captured. He was sent to Antony, and at Herod's recommendation, Antony had Antigonus executed. And this really pretty much ends the story of the Hasmonean dynasty, at least on that side. If you look at your family tree there, Antigonus is sort of the last one. There's still another son shown there on, or a daughter rather, shown on your page there that married a son of Herod. But that kind of ends that family conflict between the house of Aristobulus and the house of Hyrcanus. And that was handled by Antony with Roman authority to execute Antigonus. So Herod's in power now. Antony is his great friend and benefactor. But what happened right after that? Antony and Octavian got into the battle that we just mentioned. So now they're battling against each other, east and west. And Cleopatra has entered the picture here. I've kind of skipped over that whole story. But Cleopatra had entered from Egypt and had become sort of a big influence on Antony at this time. And she was making inroads into Herod's territory, by the way. I skipped over all of that. But she was actually being awarded some territories that belonged to Herod by Antony. So Herod wasn't too happy with what Cleopatra was doing at this point, even though he was a friend of Antony. Well, Octavian defeated Antony and Cleopatra, and as you know the story, Antony and Cleopatra committed suicide in Egypt after their big military defeat. And at that point, Herod gave his full allegiance to Octavian, who was the rival to Antony, you remember now. So this is a great story of how Herod demonstrated himself as a sort of a consummate politician, just like his father Antipater had been. He's in a precarious position, right? His main allegiance for years had been with Antony. And so Antony had been defeated by Octavian. So where do you think Herod stands with Octavian? Probably not in a very good position. He would be expected to be removed from power or maybe even executed as a staunch ally of Antony. So there's a great story here about Herod's aggressiveness and his astuteness as a politician. He actually, rather than wait to see what would happen, he went to Octavian. And Octavian, of course, is Caesar Augustus. So he went to him. He gave a speech to Octavian, a famous speech that's recorded in Josephus, about how just as he had been loyal to Antony, he would now be loyal to Octavian. And apparently he did it with such convincing that he completely won over Octavian. And Octavian was 100% convinced that this man would be a great ally to me, just like he was to Antony. And so it's probably a believable story because Octavian could clearly see what Herod wanted, which was to rule Judea. And as long as he had the support of the Roman government, Octavian probably had a lot of confidence that he was going to do that well and serve the Roman interests well, just like he had been doing previously under Antony. So this is a great example of how Herod really proved himself to be an astute politician. He had consistently aligned himself with the winners of the political wars, first with Julius Caesar, then with Antony, then with Octavian. In each of these cases, really, they had a choice as to who they were going to align themselves with. And Antipater and Herod sort of demonstrated that they were picking the right person each time and then convincing them that they would be a good ally. So that brings us to sort of a stable situation now where Herod has been, you know, he's the king of the Jews. He is now well established as the king in that area of the world under the new Roman, really the first Roman emperor, Caesar Augustus. And it's a pretty stable situation at this point in time. And I mentioned the reduction of his territory due to Cleopatra's designs on Palestine. Herod had sort of diplomatically tolerated that reduction in his territory because it was coming at the hands of Antony, really. But after Antony and Cleopatra were out of the picture, his territory gradually expanded again under Caesar Augustus to include all of the territory that we know as Palestine or the country of Israel. And it's stated that he became the third most important ruler in the Roman Empire. The second would have been Agrippa, who was another, not Herod Agrippa, but the Agrippa that Herod's sons are named after. So, at any rate, Herod became a very powerful figure in the Roman Empire. And so now we'll talk a little bit about what he did under his reign and then his character, but maybe I should pause for a second to see if anybody has any questions about all of that. Yes, Jen. The question was, did Herod have heirs? And he did. He had several sons who were, you know, I don't know how old they were at this point, but they were of ruling age when he was near his death. Several of them would have been, had they survived. Kind of giving away a little bit of the story, but we'll talk about that in just a second in more detail. Anyone else? Yes, John. Right, yeah, so that's a good question. Was he brutal, and did that help in his alignment with the powers and things like that? Yes. The answer is yes to both of those, and maybe rather than take more questions, I should just keep going because both of those points we're going to talk about here next. So Let's just plug on here. One of the things that Herod is, of course, very well known for, even down to our day, is his extensive building programs. He's well known for, if you go to Israel today, you see evidences of Herod's, you know, the archaeological ruins of Herod's building projects in many different places. Josephus puts it this way: there was not any place of his kingdom fit for the purpose that was permitted to be without somewhat that was for Caesar's honor. And when he had filled his own country with temples, he poured out the like plentiful marks of his esteem into his province and built many cities which he called Caesareas. You know, that's just a testimony to the fact that he's building things within his own kingdom, within his province. He was even building things outside of the Palestine area, even as far as Athens, if you can believe it. You know, he had huge building projects, not just buildings, but he built whole cities. One of the famous things that he did was he rebuilt the city of Caesarea. Caesarea, of course, comes from Caesar. It was named after Caesar Augustus. This was a huge project. He actually constructed a full artificial harbor by going out into the water, and I don't know exactly all the details of what he did, but he built a whole artificial harbor to allow the ships to come in. He built a theater in that city. He built an amphitheater. It was really a marvelous amount of work that was accomplished there. And you can see a lot of those evidences today if you travel to Caesarea. He rebuilt Samaria. Samaria had been destroyed earlier, and he rebuilt it, and he named it Sebasta, which is Greek for Augustus. So this is what Josephus is talking about. He built many cities and named them after Caesar Augustus. He built theaters. So within Judea and the larger province, he built theaters, stadiums, hippodromes, which are the chariot race kind of things, gymnasiums, baths, public baths, fortresses. He was well known for building some famous fortresses. And he did that not only within Palestine, but also outside of Palestine in Asia Minor, and as I mentioned, as far as Athens. And you can see those evidences in various places. Of course, he built a magnificent palace in Jerusalem, Herod's palace. And then the thing that we're probably most familiar with from the Bible is that he rebuilt the temple. So you remember the second temple, when it was rebuilt, was quite inferior to the first temple. And we see evidences of that in the rebuilding stories in Ezra. But he rebuilt the temple beginning in 19 BC, so this is a decade or so after he was firmly established in his rule, maybe more like 15 years. And we know that the work on that temple continued all the way up to 64 or 66 AD. So it was still going on. This would have been definitely going on during Jesus' lifetime. The temple itself was probably completed in about 2 years, so the temple itself was completed very quickly. But the temple grounds and the temple mount is where a lot of the further improvements happened over the years. The temple, we know, was, from various sources, was magnificent. It was, you know, probably harkened back to the Solomonic temple that was built, the first temple. And it was a magnificent piece of architecture, and Herod went to great pains to make sure that he followed the Jewish laws when the temple was being rebuilt. It's said that there was no sound of metal tools working at the site, so he had all that done off-site and had the stones brought in. So it was a very big building project. If you go to Jerusalem today and you see what's called the Wailing Wall, that's really the western side of the Temple Mount. So it's not actually a wall from the temple. It's sort of a humongous retaining wall that was built around the Temple Mount. That was part of what was done during Herod's restoration of the Temple Mount. And if you go there, I don't remember how far down it goes, but there's something like 17 courses of these enormous blocks of stone that are carefully crafted with their edges all trimmed neatly. I'm trying to remember how high up it goes, but probably as high as this room, maybe at least halfway up, probably all the way up, are the stones that are still there from Herod's time. And then on top of that, there's subsequent stones that have been added in later generations, I think in the 1500s. But you go there and these stones are enormous. This is the pictures that you see when you see someone standing right in front of the Wailing Wall. Those stones are the stones from Herod's building project. The part that's visible in the photos that you see is just a very small portion of the retaining wall. It's an enormous structure that's now mostly covered up with other buildings that have been built up against it. It's just an evidence that is probably familiar to most of you of Herod's building projects. And if you take a look closely at those pictures, you look at some of the size of the stones, and I forget how large the biggest one is, but they're enormous stones that were transported there and built up into that structure. He was also famous for building fortresses. We already mentioned Masada. Most of you are probably familiar with Masada from the final Jewish revolt when the Romans had to conquer it. You can see a lot of pictures of Masada in various places. That was a fortress that he built really for himself, and the three tiers on the lower side are called Herod's palace. You can see those in the photos. He also built another fortress by the name of Herodium, which is sort of a mountain that has the top cut off, and he built a fortress down inside it, and that's actually where he's buried, or where he was buried. So he's well known for these really remarkable building projects that he did throughout Judea as well as even outside the province of Judea. Now, you might be wondering what happened to Hyrcanus. Following the defeat of Antigonus, who was later executed, Hyrcanus, of course, couldn't be reinstated as high priest because he had been maimed, so he was unfit for the high priesthood. And at this point, Herod began appointing priests himself. He appointed some 7 priests during his rule. And really, that's important because that was the end of the hereditary priesthood. He is now appointing priests, and then later we see the Romans are actually in charge of who's being appointed as the high priest. He did have Hyrcanus executed also later because he viewed him as a threat to the throne. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. So that, just kind of a very, very brief overview of some of his building projects and things like that. Some of the other questions that we had were, what was his character like? We read a little bit in the New Testament of Herod, and we have some ideas, but what was his character like? So before we talk about some of his more murderous traits that we're probably familiar with, it's probably important to point out some other things. First of all, you can tell from his building projects that he was actually a very generous ruler. He was seeking to find favor with the Jews throughout his rule. So he was very generous. There's many stories of his generosity towards the Jews and towards various folks. He had a lot of goodwill towards the Jews, you know, probably mostly politically motivated, although a little bit religious. He viewed himself religiously as a Jew, even though he came from Idumea. And so there was a lot of goodwill that Herod had towards the Jews. And of course, he was trying to build a name for himself, which is one of the things you do when you're making a lot of building projects. Even if he was naming them cities and things after his benefactors, the Caesars, he of course was trying to build a name for himself and leave himself a big legacy. You can talk about Herod's Temple, Masada, Herodium is named after him. So he was definitely leaving architectural wonders that people would continue to talk about for years to come. So those are some character traits that come out if you read Josephus about Herod. You see a lot of these descriptions. Of course, I've mentioned before, so he's an Idumean by descent, which is an Edomite, but he claimed to be a Jew by religion. And to further that end, he married into the Hasmonean family. And again, this is maybe the last time we'll refer to the family tree. But you can see that he married a Hasmonean princess by the name of Mariamne, and she's right at the bottom of your family tree there. She was actually descended from both Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, if you look at the connections there. So this was something that he did to solidify his claim to the throne. He married this Hasmonean princess, you know, again, was always trying to work really hard to establish himself as a legitimate ruler of the Jews, a legitimate king of the Jews. So there may be a lot of stereotypes about Herod. we focus a lot on his murderous character because of what we know from the birth narrative of Jesus. Probably most of us think of him as sort of a weakling who was paranoid about a baby taking over his throne, and maybe he was a little unsettled mentally. That's kind of a stereotype that I always had of him before I read a lot of this, but he was really an able leader, and Josephus goes so far as to actually describe some of his physical skills. He says that he was an excellent hunter, had great skill in riding horses, was such a warrior as could not be withstood, was skilled in throwing javelin and shooting arrows, and that he had a body suited to his soul. So you get here the impression of a very vivacious and aggressive personality who had the physical skills to match it. I've skipped over a lot of the wars that were happening in this time. Herod was an able military leader. He was at the forefront of many military conflicts, and he had many great successes as a military leader. So he was a very strong, I think this is probably accurate, he was a very strong warrior type person. So if you had that same stereotype that I had about this kind of weakling, you know, guy who was trying to tenuously grasp hold of being king of the Jews, it's probably a little misfounded. He was a very able person who was to be reckoned with. So, with all that said, now we get to the part where he was definitely very cruel and a despot who killed many of his friends and family to solidify his rule, first of all, but then also at the end of his life, which is kind of lines up with what we see in the birth narratives, he really was becoming paranoid and unstable. So he executed his wife. By all indications, he really loved his wife, Mariamne, but he had these fits of jealousy, and in one of these fits of jealousy, he had her executed. He executed his mother-in-law, who was sort of really contriving behind the scenes to unseat him. So that one is a little bit maybe justifiable, if you can think of it from that perspective. But he executed his brother-in-law, his uncle, all of the survivors of the Hasmonean family. So Hyrcanus would be one of those who was a survivor of the Hasmonean family. He was executed because, again, they were viewed as a threat to him because they had a claim to be legitimate rulers. Jen, you were asking about his offspring. He had a number of sons, three of whom were executed. Alexander and Aristobulus were two of his sons of Mariamne. They were really the prime people who were positioned to be the heirs to the throne. They had been educated in Rome. There was a lot of political intrigue, suspicions of them being involved in a conspiracy to unseat Herod. It's not clear whether any of it was true or not, but he ended up having both of those sons executed. And then he had another son who was the next heir to the throne by the name of Antipater. And Antipater was jailed under suspicion of a conspiracy again, and he was executed while Herod was on his deathbed, only 5 days before his own death. And that led to this famous quote here by Caesar Augustus, "I would rather be Herod's swine than his son." And that's a play on the Greek word there that I've given you in your handout, hous instead of huios. So it's a little bit of a pun, but he said, "I'd rather be Herod's swine than his son." Swine presumably being very safe because Herod wouldn't be killing pigs as a Jew. However, he was murdering off all of his sons. So that's coming from Caesar. So that kind of gives you an idea of what's going on there. In his last years, he became more suspicious and jealous. Really, this is to the point of a mania or a paranoia. And you may have heard this. He's rumored to have ordered the execution of leaders in Jerusalem when he died so that he could make sure that there was going to be mourning in the land when he died. As far as we know, that was not actually carried out, but it is said that was something he ordered. And then, of course, we know about the order of the execution of the children in Bethlehem. So it would have been about this period, most likely, near the end of his life, that Jesus was born. And the wise men, of course, came searching. And what were they searching for? What did they ask the king of the Jews. How would that sit with Herod? He was the rightful official king of the Jews. So you can see how he would probably be pretty alarmed by this group of people coming from the east asking, where's the king of the Jews? You know, he would say, I'm the king of the Jews. Or maybe you're talking about one of my sons who is the one that's born king of the Jews. So you can see how that would have been deemed a very big threat to Herod, and how he would probably easily want to find out more about this and then order the execution of anyone who might possibly fit that description in the town of Bethlehem. So the biblical account here fits in very well with the historical evidence that we have from other sources and what was going on with Herod. Now, I have a quote here from Merrill Tenney, which puts the order of the execution of the infants in perspective, maybe. Tenney says this, Matthew's account of Herod's reaction to the visit of the Magi is quite in keeping with his known temperament, and the butchery of a few infants in Bethlehem by Herod's guards would, in comparison with his greater crimes, have passed almost unnoticed. So you could see easily how something like that in a small town of Bethlehem, sort of out-of-the-way place, a few infants, you know, we don't know exactly how many infants were killed there, but it probably wasn't a large number. You can easily see how that would have not even been noticed by what was all the stuff that was going on. When Herod is killing off his whole family and, you know, and ordering that all the leaders be executed when he's dead. So hopefully when you read that story now, it puts it into a little more perspective on what was happening politically at the time.